have a live mic that is weirdly not as loud as I thought it would be. So I moved that. Okay. So last time, we talked a bit about sort of generally things we'd be covering this semester and logistics for the class. Then we started getting into talking about building programs, particularly focusing on C programs. We mentioned some things that I think you saw in CS01, but sort of weren't really made clear. So we talked about sort of the multi-step process of making a C program. So typically we have sort of a compiling and assembling steps, and you did that, or could have done that, maybe you didn't actually, by passing the minus C option to your compiler, specifying that I only want to go as far as compiling and assembling, don't take any further, and you would get a .o file, which, you know, contains, you know, all the information in the C file, the things it includes that are needed to make the executable, and includes the conversion to machine code that is close to ready to go in the executable. But then we have to combine object files and libraries together because, well, we don't have all our code for our application in each C file. We have it split across C files, and some of it's in libraries that we didn't write and aren't compiling right now. And so we do this linking step, which is going to take those object files and some system files and make an executable. And one thing we'll often use is libraries that will have, you know, not an object file with sort of code, but we'll have some assembled bunch of object files, for example, for the C library, or maybe other libraries other people might have written for us, that we want to use together. And we learned that the way on traditional Unix compilers we specify using a library is we specify with this minus capital L option where to find the library, this minus lowercase l option, what the name of the library to look for there is, and we can have these two types of libraries. We have these static libraries, which are basically just a collection of the object files, just conveniently put together into an archive, like a zip archive, basically. And when we link these, they get included in the actual executable, so we don't need anything else. And then there are dynamic libraries, which on Linux have the extension .so for shared object, which aren't actually included in the executable themselves. We need to have them to know how to make the executable that will find them, but when the executable runs, it actually is going to load that .so file from somewhere on the system and set up to use that code to call the functions that are in that .so file, you know, using whatever version it finds on the system. And one complication of this we mentioned is that, well, this means that just because I made an executable successfully doesn't mean the executable is going to run. I need to set it up so at runtime when I start it, it will actually find these dynamic libraries that it needs to load. And, you know, it's going to do that by looking in some system specified locations and maybe some other locations we can configure either at executable production time or when before we run the executable. So questions about things we covered last time or logistics issues? Yes?
I missed the first day of class. I had to fly back. Do you post the slides?
So the question is, are lecture slides or other things available? Yes. So on the course website linked off Canvas, there's a schedule page. The schedule page has recordings and links to the slides, which might be a guess at what the slides will be from last semester for future lectures and should be the actual slide I showed you sometime after the lecture. Generally, I'm probably going to post recordings the evening of. It's not going to be instantaneous because some video processing needs to happen to make them viewable consistently for everyone without technical difficulties. Other questions, logistics, or on things we covered last time? So let's talk a little about some anonymous feedback. So complaints that the Gloid is very difficult to get to. If you have classes around this, before this, or after this, I agree. I'm pretty sure there's not an alternate room. I did not email our scheduling person and said, please put me a 15-minute walk from Rice. I love getting a nice walk down JPA. No. Not my preference for a room. There's just large lecture rooms have very limited availability on campus, so the CS department takes what we can get. I started lecture a little bit late. I'll probably do that. And I'm gathering from how eager people were to leave Tuesday that there's some people with pressure on the other end of the class, too. I'll try to avoid that. I know I have a bad habit of going really right up to the wire of the end of my lecture time. I'll need to work on. Okay, and then a logistic issue. So we have quizzes, including one that will be due before lecture next week. And we'll talk about sort of the quiz interface. So I have a demo quiz page here that is not our real quizzes. But our quiz page is linked off the website. I should show what that looks like so you know how to find it. So it's linked in multiple places, but one place you can find it is if you click quizzes here, you will get taken. Come on. I did make this link work, yes. When the internet works, which I hopefully did not break. Okay, yes, we actually have. Okay, live demos. Which probably means that this is going to be awkward. This loaded. So. Well, hopefully that will. So, the quiz site. So, you're going to have this list of quizzes. It will look different for our class than this demo. You're going to open a quiz. And, oh, of course. Yes. Why would I have working internet here? That's a luxury that I have. Or why wouldn't the server the quizzes are on just break when I'm doing this? That's interesting. Okay. So, in the interest of interesting. So it appears that the server running the quizzes is not up, which was definitely a problem. Okay, so I will hope this problem resolves itself while I'm giving this lecture and revisit it later. And if not, I might need to change how the quiz, do something about the first week's quiz, because you won't know how things work, necessarily. Yes?
I was wondering what would happen if there's, major site stops like this?
So the question is, what will I do if there's, major technical issues with taking quizzes and the like? I will generally make an extension or drop the quiz. And if I can't get an actual demo of it, I probably will just drop the first week's quiz and move the questions I had planned, mix it into the next week's quiz. I would really like to know why the server, which also runs the submission site, is not up, because it definitely was up earlier today. Yeah?
This is just in relation to that. I think last lecture you mentioned that we all have this. Is that still the case?
So the question is about lab locations, where the labs are. So the 5 and 6:30 p.m. labs will all be in Rice 130. The 3:30 will still be split based on how many people are registered for that. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, so for clarity, like if the server still isn't working, you drop the quiz, that doesn't count against like the get one drop quiz, right?
The question, if the server is still not working, I drop the quiz, doesn't count against one drop quiz? No, it's just there, we have less quizzes this semester. Okay, other questions? Okay, so in other questions, so some people, anonymous feedback said they wanted some more review of concepts from before. So we learn new content, and probably one of the things is about C. Some other stuff is probably about the compilation stuff, but I hopefully went over that enough where you could hopefully ask more questions so I know what I'm missing. And as far as getting a C refresher, that is one of the purposes of the work assignment, but based on past experience, maybe it's worth going over some C topics here. I'm making an educated guess as to what parts of C people have trouble with, which might be a wrong guess. And my guess is pointers. So let's do a little check to see where people are. So here's some code. After this code runs, what's the value of array? take more time? Okay, so let's see. So who thinks, by show of hands, who thinks it's A, there's some compiler runtime error that's likely to happen? Like, we'll compile or it'll seg fault. Okay? Couple people. Who thinks B? Okay. C? D? E? F? Okay, so we have a majority saying B, and this is the answer I get. And based on this, I don't think I should spend lecture time doing my more detailed pointer review stuff. Except if you have specific questions, though I'll be happy to talk about that in office hours or similar. So just to go give a quick explanation of what goes on here, we have our array in memory, so which let's say it starts at address 10,000 here, then because this is ints, our next box would be address 1004, then 1008, and if we're using hex, 100C. Those are where our four array elements are. We set P to point to at array 0, which we could have also written P equals array. We do the same thing, and that is the same as setting P to have the address if the array is at 1000, 1000. Then we do P plus equals 2, and this increments the address by the size of two integers. So at this point, this means that P points to array of 2, or it has, in our example, the address 1008. So the compiler generated code to add 8 to it, because that's the size of two ints. It takes into account what the pointer points to when we do addition on the pointers. And then we did P bracket 1. And what this is equivalent to is this is equivalent to taking P plus 1. And remember, the plus takes into account. So advance P by one integer, then access memory at that location, and do something with that. So this is P plus 1 plus equals 1. This is going to give us the address. We start at array of 2. So we start here. So this is star P is that. So star the quantity P plus 1 is the last element of the array, the one with index 3, since we have a pointer to index 2. And we add 1 to that, which is how we get 4, 1, and there's no other modifications to the array. So questions about this? Yeah?
So when it's incrementing addresses with P plus equals 2, how does it know the size of each integer? Is that through malloc?
So the question is, how does it know the size of each integer? So if we look at how P is declared, when we declared P, we put the word int here. So that's how the compiler knows. So it says, oh, this is declared as pointing to an int. Therefore, I'm going to use the size of an integer on this system. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes, back there.
Can you re-explain what the ampersand did?
Can I explain what the ampersand did? Sure. So if we have array of 0, this is the value 10, right? That's what array of 0 is at the beginning. And we don't want to actually have the pointer contain the value 10, because pointers don't contain values, they contain addresses. So we want the pointer to contain the address of 10, and the ampersand operator takes something, so ampersand of blank is the address of the thing. So we're getting the address of the array of that 10. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, other questions? Okay. And so just general things on review. If you wanted to review, my sort of first recommendations would be you can review the CSO1 things, labs 9 through 12 in particular. Also, if you want to do sort of coding exercises by yourself, things we've used in the past that you probably didn't do in CSO1 are implementing string set or conversions from dynamic arrays to linked list or vice versa. If you just want to sort of practice pointers, those are possible ideas. I've heard of people, TAs have mentioned using code challenge sites in C and things like that for the review also. Other questions on C review issues before I talk about make? Okay. So we're going to talk about back to building programs. So we talked about sort of how to do it by hand, sort of how to make object files, briefly what libraries are and linking them. We're going to talk about automating that process, and in particular, automating the part of it where if things change, we rerun the commands, but not all of them, just the ones that we need to rerun. And make is a very old program that supports this and works in a similar way to the way sort of other things that do this, like IDEs and so on, will work. And with make, you actually specify the commands to build it, and it runs them based on rules you write in a configuration file called a makefile. So that makefile contains what we call rules for creating files. So for example, here's a simple rule for making main.o. And we have a bunch of parts to this rule. So first, we have what's called the target, the thing that this rule is creating. In this case, it's main.o. And then we have a colon. And after the colon are the prerequisites. So these are the things that this main.o is created from. So in this case, main.o is created from main.c. That's the obvious one. But also, we know that even though we don't specify main.h and extra.h in the command line, that when the compiler reads main.c, there's includes. And so if main.h changes or extra.h changes, we probably need to recompile main.c. And so we list all the prerequisites here after the colon. And then we have one or more lines. I just have one in this example, but we could have multiple, specifying what commands to run. And in make, these lines are prefixed by a tab character. And by a tab character, I mean a literal tab character, not like 8 spaces or 4 spaces. It has to be an actual tab character. This is an artifact of make being a very old tool. It's before people's text editors commonly made it annoying to type in a literal tab character. But to write make files, that's something you're going to need to figure out how to do for the lab next week and for the warm-up homework. So there's a tab character and then prefixing each command to run. And what make is going to do is make is going to look at these rules, and when you tell make, I want to make main.o be up to date, it's going to check each of the prerequisites. So it's going to look at main.c, main.h, extra.h, see if any of them are modified more recently than main.o is. And if so, it's going to run that command. Otherwise, it's not going to bother running the command because it looks like it's not needed. Main.o has already been created from the current version of all those files. So questions about our simple make rule before we talk about multiple of them? This question is the point that it makes updating easier than it normally would be? Yes. So we're going to be able to have multiple of these rules. So you won't have to figure out by hand which commands we have to rerun, as we'll see. So we'll get to that example here. So one thing that make is going to do that's going to be particularly useful is that make is going to be recursive in how it applies these rules. So in addition to running this command to update main.o, it's first going to check, are each of these files up to date. And in this example, well, that doesn't make much sense, right? Because we don't run a command to create min.h. But if we think of making a full program, we're going to have a rule to create our program from our object files, and each of our object files will have a rule to create them. And make is going to figure out, when we ask to make the program, it's going to check, do I need to update main.o and extra.o? And it's going to apply these rules recursively. So it's going to do sort of the whole process of checking what the commands need to be run for the whole program that we specified by sort of following these rules recursively. Questions? Okay, so we're going to have a file with a bunch of these rules, and often these rules will kind of reference each other, like you see here. And then we want to actually have make use these rules to build something. So how do we do that? So the command is called make, and what we can generally do is we can run the command make and the name of a target, the name of the thing before colon on one of the rules. And it's going to look for a make file, that configuration file. And the way it looks for that is it just looks for a file called literally make file, just that name in the current directory. And then it's going to sort of make that target be up to date. So in some cases, it might do nothing. It might say, oh, yep, target's more recent than everything that it depends on. I'm done. In other cases, it's going to check, going to find that things aren't up to date, and it's going to rebuild things. You can also specify multiple targets. And commonly, you'll see people, when they distribute software that uses makefiles, just tell you to run make, no arguments. And how that works is it looks for the first rule in the makefile and just uses that. And so that's why in my example here, program was my first rule. So the default thing to do if I just type make in the directory with this in a make file is that it will build program. Some questions about invocation? Yes?
When you're saying up to date, do you mean it hasn't been changed since the last time it was compiled?
So the question is, what does up to date mean? So if we look at our rules here, up to date means that each of its prerequisites is up to date and it is more recent than its prerequisites as far as its modification comes. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so on that, let's say I have a makefile here. I run make w, and here are my modification times. That's how make is checking whether things are up to date. So what commands should it, will running make w run in this case? You can check with your neighbors, see if you agree on what's supposed to go on.
Thank you.
Who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's see who thinks A, B, C, D, okay, E, F, and G. No clue. Okay, so we have a plurality saying E, which I believe is what I got. And some people didn't want us to build X, which is, so we'll talk about sort of my explanation about what happens here. So we want to make W, and I have kind of just a graph of what our sort of prerequisites are. So W needs X and Y, Y needs X and Z, X needs Q. And to make W, we need X and Y up to date, so I'll just go in order. So first I need X up to date. So my question is X up to date? And we might say, well, X is, you know, less recent than W, so as far as W is concerned, it's up to date, but if we look at X's rule, X depends on Q. So for X to be up to date, Q also needs to be less recent than X, and it's not. Q was updated, and we didn't propagate that update to X for some reason. So we're going to need to build X in order to fix that. So that's our first step. So we're going to build X because it doesn't include whatever we did to Q that 2 hours ago. Then we've just updated Y, and Y needs X up to date and Z up to date. Well, X is up to date, but and Z is up to date, but then we have to check, now do we need to update Y to handle what changed? And well, yes, for two reasons. So one is Y doesn't exist, so it is not more recent than Z, which is three hours ago. Like, we haven't made those 3 hour changes to make Y happen. Also, X we just updated, and Y needs to include that, so we need to run build Y to handle having just updated X. And then we'll go back and figure out, oh, we just updated X and Y, therefore we need to update W, because even though W is only a minute old, it doesn't include the changes we just made to X and Y, so we're also going to have to run building W. So questions? This process, yes?
Essentially, even though Y doesn't exist, you can consider that to be like infinitely old, therefore everything else looks
young. The question is, even though, since Y doesn't exist, we can kind of consider it to be infinitely old, yes. That is generally how you should look at, yeah, how we're going to compare modification times. Okay. Other questions? Yes? The slides on the schedule doesn't have this? Yes. That is because if you were looking at the slides on the schedule and then trying to answer the question, it would kind of give away the answer. I will post the PDF with that after lecture. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that's how our rule processing works. Now, one thing I mentioned here, we just found out here is that, oh, non-existent files, that means we're going to think, oh, we always have to try to rerun the rule for them to make them. But a common thing you'll see in make files is they'll have targets that aren't intended to be files. So for example, if I have a thing with multiple executables in a library, I might have wanted to be the case where I can make all to create all of them, to compile and link all of them. And I don't actually have a file called all. And probably this doesn't get us in trouble, because what make is going to do is, well, all doesn't have any commands to run, so we won't run any commands. It's just going to, if there were commands, it would run them every time. So, you know, this is a common thing that people do. And there's some other conventional targets. So for example, clean is a common target for get rid of files that were generated, so I can sort of start over. So a common thing is you'll have a target called clean that removes the O files. So even if the modification times say we shouldn't, we'll make them again, maybe because I like change my compiler settings or something like that. But there's kind of an issue with this, and that is, you know, what if I make a file called all in the directory? Suddenly, make all doesn't work very well. Or if I make a file called clean, make clean doesn't work very well. That file's more recent, it's just gonna not actually build the things we want to build when it probably should. And just might generally get confused. Especially for clean, write clean here doesn't actually have any dependencies. So if I make a file called clean and I make clean, well, it's gonna say, oh, there's a file called clean. Everything meet clean depends on is there, we're good. That's not what we want. So a feature that makes supports to deal with this kind of case where we have these targets that aren't actually things we want to create, they're just kind of tools for someone on the command line to do common tasks, is that we can mark rules as phony. And the way this is done is that we have this special target .phony, and we specify its dependencies, and this just tells the make tool that these aren't real files, that don't look for a file called clean. You're not gonna find one. Just treat it as something that you always have to do if it's specified. So if I type make clean, always run the rm command, don't check if there's a file called clean. If I run make all, always build all those things, don't check if there's a file called all to decide whether or not to do that, that's not relevant. Yes?
So you put like the phony rules that are like a file or something, or like specify, or like where do you put the...
Where do I put the phony? This whole text here is what would be in the make file. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. Question, does the order of things matter in the make file? Yes, but only for... this, what happens if I just type make? That's where the order matters. Otherwise, it basically doesn't matter. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Question, if we had a file called all and we ran make all, what would we do? My understanding is make would just not look at the file called all. I'm not 100% sure that's what happens, especially since there are multiple different versions of make, like the default make on OS X is different than Linux. But I believe it would just ignore the file called all. So I believe it would just ignore the file called all. But I'm not sure that happens in every version of make that's out there. Other questions? Okay, so these phony rules give us ways to make these kind of conventional targets, and there's no like requirement that you have any of them, but commonly when you see software distributed with makefiles, you'll have a bunch of conventional targets. So you'll have the default will usually be called all just by a convention people have used for several decades, and that's going to build everything. So if we have multiple executables, multiple libraries, if you just type make or make all, the convention is to set up the make file so that based on the dependencies of that default target, that which is usually going to be called all, we'll make everything be built. So you don't have to specify the names of each of their executables by hand. Also, though commonly, if you have a way of installing it to some location, there will be an install target that will copy the executables to where they're expected to be run from. You might have a test target to run tests. And commonly, you'll have a target called clean that just removes generated files. So this is something that like shouldn't be necessary in normal use, but let's say I change from GCC to Clang, I want to recompile everything. make clean would remove all the object files so you could actually recompile and not have it say, oh, well, you didn't modify the C file, so I don't need to recompile it. Yeah. So make clean would be a way of handling that kind of situation. Other so questions on these? Conventional targets. Okay, so something you might have noticed if you're thinking about writing a makefile for a large project, you know, let's say we have several hundred files, is that we have a lot of redundancy. So we're going to talk about ways that make lets us not write things that are as redundant. And an example of how we have redundancy, here I have these two rules here. And let's say I want to change my makefile, so I pass dash WO. I've learned that it's good to have warnings. I should enable warnings. It seems like I have to change it in three places, or if I want to change from plain to GCC. So that's kind of annoying. So is there a way we can avoid that? And yes. So one thing that make provides are variables, or macros is the official name, but commonly they kind of look like variables if you're familiar with shell, where I can specify sort of things in one place in my makefile and use them later. So rather than typing the name of the compiler each time, I set CC to GCC, and then if I want to change from GCC to Clang, I just edit that line. I don't edit everywhere in my makefile. I can specify, say, common flags I want to pass to my commands, and so on this way. And what I've shown here are sort of common conventional names you'll see in makefiles, is that often they'll be written with CC being what C compiler do we use, C flags being what flags do you provide to the C compiler, and so on. But you could use other names if you wanted. Yes?
So I see just equals instead of equals. Can you also use just equals?
Question, you see equals instead of colon equals, so you've learned from, say, our readings that I could have written this. Yes, in this case, those would both do the same thing. There is actually a difference between the two, which I don't have memorized. That is usually not relevant. But there is a difference in how it works when you have variables that reference variables, which usually we won't be doing. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Question, are these variables defined in the makefile? Yes. Again, like our prior examples, this is actual contents of a makefile that you could have. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, do I need to put things other than my object file, other than what I showed on that sort of dependency chart? Generally, you should not need that. You could put extra stuff there, but like you're just specifying, you just have things that correspond to the commands you want to run, is how I would look at it, right? What commands do I want run? That should be, I should have things in my make file for each of those. Other questions? Yeah. What is GCC?
Yeah.
In the sense of here?
Yeah.
So here I'm specifying, so I have these commands here, right? And I'm specifying I want to run, so GCC is a compiler that's not Clang. So I'm specifying here, I want to use GCC by having CC at the top, and then I'm referring to that thing at the top with this dollar parentheses around CC. And the advantage of this is that, let's say I decided, no, GCC is a, you know, not the compiler I want. I'm used to Clang, I want to switch to Clang. If I wanted to do that, I could just edit this file to, instead of saying CC equals GCC, to say CC equals Clang. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, yes, sorry.
Yeah,
So question, if I wanted to use different compilers for different things, could I have two different variables? Absolutely, and I just need to make sure when I wrote the rules, I used the correct ones. Because there's, like, the names I'm using here are just, they're the names you're likely to see, but you can change them. There's nothing special about those names as far as what's going on here. So I could, instead of using CC, I could use foo, you know, for any foo. Other questions? Okay, so we've gotten rid of a bunch of redundancy here, or at least I'm not saying clang or, you know, whatever, my compile options all the time. But we still have a bunch of kind of annoying redundancy in that I have to kind of type the names of my .o files twice, the name of my program twice, the name of my C files twice. There's a lot of stuff going on here where, you know, it seems like maybe I could, you know, save some redundancy, and there's some automatic variables that are a solution for that. So I have to look up what the names of these are every time, so please don't, I don't expect you to memorize the dollar what symbol, but the dollar ampersand symbol, this is the target of the current rule, and this dollar up arrow, up caret, is the dependencies, I should say prerequisites, since that's the term that I've used before, the prerequisites of the current rule. And this dollar less than, this is the first prereq of the current rule. So in this way, I only am typing the names of my C and O files once in the rule, each rule, so that helps a bit. Yes? Question, do I only use ldlibs when I make an executable? So this ldlibs here, I'm passing the name of is a macro, which expands in this case to -lm. So lm is including a library, in this case the m library, which is by convention the math library. And the libraries only matter when we're making the executable, so I don't need to provide that option elsewhere. It's not going to change anything. Yes?
Is there an annotation for any other specific prerequisite?
Question, is there a notation for any other specific prerequisite? I'm not aware of one, but I would have to look it up. Yes?
Is the benefit of using macros as variables like the repeatability, or is there actual logistical reasons why that would be better to use instead of writing it out?
So the question is the benefit to improve readability, or are there logistical reasons? So there's going to be a logistical reason we'll see on the next slide. But otherwise, it's mostly readability / avoiding redundancy thing. Other questions? So you'll notice in getting rid of all this redundancy, my two rules here look essentially the same now, as far as what the command to run is, because of all these sort of macros. And I can take advantage of this to make a single rule that kind of handles both cases. You might say, wait a moment, how does that work? You know, the rules we've seen so far, we have to specify one target, we can't specify two different targets and do different things. So there's some extra types of rules that are kind of, you know, wildcard rules. They handle multiple cases, and there's sort of two ways that they can be written. So one is called what are called suffix rules. And they have this very non-intuitive syntax that I've highlighted in red here. And this says, which is .c.o. And this is basically a placeholder. And this is equivalent to writing any, I should, yeah, so, any, for dot O, any dot C, where any could be anything. It will just find, if it finds something dot O, it will look for a dot C that it corresponds to it. So instead of writing all my rules for something dot O depends on something dot C and then we build it, I just have this one rule which says anything with dot O, look for a dot C. If you find one, use these instructions. So this is called a suffix rule. Yes?
So is the only way it matches is if they have the same exact file name or have a detail?
Is the only way it matches if they have the same exact file name? Yes, same exact file name excluding the extension. Yes? So the question is, could I add more extensions to this one rule than dot O?
Well, I just want to make sure I understand. So I can also write dot C, that would get dot to dot file.
I can also write dot C. Oh, so this is a special syntax which only deals with one type of extension depends on another. So we can only specify two extensions using this syntax. So in this case, I'm saying C files turn into .o files. I could do this for other types of files that turn into .o files, for example, but I can't like use the same syntax to have a rule for like C files turning into nothing, you know, just by themselves. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, what's going on with the lines below? So it turns out that you can kind of specify your rules for a target in multiple places. So we can specify kind of extra dependencies along the side for extra.o and main.o, but it's still going to look for where the build instructions are in some other part of the makefile. So it's going to combine, you know, our dependencies for extra.o with the actual rule for building .o files, and the same thing for main.o. So in this way, we can just specify the dependencies, but it's going to use kind of this wildcard rule to handle the actual process of, you know, building it. So it's going to combine all the rules that match main.o to figure out how to build main.o, and all the rules that match extra.o. So I basically specified the part that's common for all the .o files in this wildcard rule, but I have additional stuff to handle this part that's different for each one, in which case, this case is what the dependencies are. Does that answer your question? Yes?
If we had some other, let's just say .o and .c file that didn't have any other dependencies, and we wanted that to also be like updated main, would we have to also like write that out?
So the question is, if I had a .o file which didn't have any .h dependencies, would I need to have one of these extra things? No. I would not need an extra line to specify the dependencies since there are no additional ones. And was there a question up there? Or, I guess not. Okay. So this is the oldest syntax for doing this kind of wildcard rules, and I think the least intuitive. There's a newer and possibly less portable syntax called pattern rules, which I find more intuitive. This basically specifies the same thing. There's some subtle differences, but basically this is the same thing. I find this a more understandable syntax where a percent sign basically represents anything and says anything.o, look for anything.c, and if so, use this rule. Yes? So the question is, how does that symbol know which files to look for? You do not have to write them down underneath it. My understanding is that it looks for the file either being in the directory or there being a rule to make the file. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Could I also do this with different file names? Yes.
I mean like file endings instead of like.
Could I do this with different file endings? Yes, I can. I can do %.foo, %.bar, that and specify whatever commands I want. So in this way, sort of make does not know anything about what your compiler does. All it knows is it's looking for certain file names and running the commands you specify. Yes, up there.
Why is this less portable?
Why is this less portable? Basically, just that the make utility on Unix systems originally did not support this. So if your make utility is very old or some very small version, it might not still not have that code because there's multiple sort of multiple different versions written by different people of make. Does that answer your question? Yes. Can I explain what the bottom two lines are? Sure. So this rule just specifies the .o files depend on .c files and are built this way, but we have additional information we need to provide about our particular .o files, that they depend on .h files. And we can do that by specifying that here, and make will kind of combine all the rules that apply for main.o and extra.o together. Yes?
What's the difference between when you use the percentage sign and when you didn't use the percent sign?
What's the difference between when I used the percent sign and when I didn't use the percent sign? There's essentially no difference. There's probably some corner case differences, other than that this is a newer, more flexible syntax that might be slightly less widely supported. Yeah? Question, are we restricted to only specifying two? I do not believe so, but I don't know. It probably depends on which version of make, the details of exactly how complicated the patterns can be. Yeah?
Can you do %.h, or does that not work?
Can I do %.h? Yes. You could do that. That's usually not useful because usually you don't, because that would imply you always have a .h file for every .c file, which isn't true in many projects. Yeah?
So to clarify, that just means that every .o file is a target, every .c file is a dependency?
No? Question, this means that every .o file is a target based on every .c file? Yes. Okay. Other questions? Okay. And so these rules seem very nice, and this is still a lot of redundancy, right? It seems like every time I make a C project, I'm going to be writing a rule like this. And it turns out that make has those rules built in. So you might see make files where they don't write that because they have basically this rule with the name CC and C flags built in, so you could just write like this and not even specify how to build it. Okay, some questions? Yeah?
So can you clarify again why we don't need to specify .h specifically, but we need to specify .c files?
Question, why does this rule specify .c and not .h?
Yeah.
And that's because if I think of a of C programs in general, I don't need to have a .h file for every .c file, right? If my, if like a typical, you know, main function, right, I don't need to have that call from anywhere else, so I don't need a .h file for it, and that can happen often in real projects too. Or I might not have, I might have one .h file that's implemented in several .c files.
Okay.
Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. What does it mean for the rule to be built in? That means that basically it's as if if you don't specify a rule that overrides it, it's in your make file by default, even though you didn't type it there. Yes, back there. The question is, does the built-in rule use these variables? Yes. And you'd have to look up in the manual what the built-in rules are, but they have particular variables they decide to use. Other questions? Okay. So one thing you might notice here is that we haven't automated the process of writing the .h dependencies, and that's actually kind of error-prone. There's some ways to automate that. We're not going to do them, but I'd like you to know they exist. So GCC and Clang both have this dash capital M option where they will output a make rule that is basically going to be this line. So they'll read, figure out what .h files are included, and basically give you the line to put in the make file. And some more complicated projects will often have ways of just running that command to actually figure out what the dependencies are so you don't have to update the makefile by hand. Also, there's lots of programs that write makefiles. So if you download lots of software for Unix-like systems, you often have the build instructions will say, first run this command, then run make. And the first command is going to write a makefile. And one reason they might do this is to automate setting the dependencies and other things like that. Also, there are some other build systems. And you know, if I were choosing a build system to use, I wouldn't choose make because you know, it doesn't automate some things I'd like to automate. So there's a whole bunch of other build systems. But the way they work is sort of conceptually very similar to make. The key kind of idea is you have these rules about how to generate a file, and you're checking modification times to figure out whether to run them. So it's kind of the same basic concept, just different ways of specifying that, different levels of things that are built in, but they kind of work in the same way. Questions? Build systems generally. Okay, so yes, I guess I will be not have a quiz this week unless the network has fixed itself, but guess not. So, in our last 5 minutes, I can do the quiz demo. Good, okay. So we will do the quiz demo in our last 5 minutes. And I guess I'm not getting to any of the exception stuff today, which is fine. But that means I'm sorry for people who did the reading. You did the reading for next time. And I need to update the web page. OK, so here's our example quiz site for how quizzes work. So you're going to open up a quiz. And we're going to. And when you open up the quiz, you're going to get something that looks like this. There might be a confirmation dialog to open up the quiz, but you'll have a quiz interface. And you'll have a bunch of questions, which will be select all that apply type questions. And when you click a question, the box around the question should turn green. When it turns green, your answer is recorded. You do not need to submit. Click a submit button. It is recorded. You will take the last thing that is recorded for your answer, and that will be what you get. You can also write comments in your quiz questions. So I think this question is ambiguous because. And this is a place where you can show your reasoning, or if you think you made a mistake in writing the question, that's where you did it. We'll have TAs read those comments and adjust your grades accordingly. This will obviously not happen instantaneously, so please, even though the quiz page will show your scores immediately afterwards, like those adjustments won't be included. And when you focus outside the box where the comments are, the box turns green, indicating that it is recorded. If it doesn't turn green, if it stays yellow, it's not recorded, like your Wi-Fi doesn't work, or some network problem happened with the server again, which hopefully will not happen. We also have stored answer questions, which you can write and select one questions. So as I said, the last version of what you submit will be recorded. You can go back. You can go back any time to the quiz and you'll still see your answers there. And I guess I should mention, the first time you open up the quiz, you will see a confirmation, do you really want to open it up? When the quiz is finished, it will show you your scores. When our graders read things, it will show you feedback from the graders and any score adjustment. And it has these percentages, which are how many students answered each of those answers. So you can get an idea of, was it a question everyone got wrong, or just you, or whatever. And also, you can submit regrade requests, and we will look at them in a week or two. So questions on the quiz system? I understand some people are going. Okay, and the first quiz will be out due before lecture next Tuesday, and I will send an email reminder about an announcement on Canvas about that to remind everyone, since I'm sure they will forget.